And a Radio Derb is on the air. This is your nostalgically genial host, John Derbyshire, with the Christmas weekend broadcast, which begins, of course, with the hope that you all enjoyed a holiday full of warmth, affection, good cheer, and plentiful nutritive refreshment. The news is, as usual, rather depressing all over. It's not to be ignored, of course, and I shall return to it in future broadcasts. This week, however, rather than cast a pall of gloom over your festivities, I shall take you on a trip down memory lane. This past year, 2014, we marked the 10th anniversary of Radio Derb. I thought it would be fun, and perhaps instructive, to glance back over the first 10 Christmas broadcasts, from Christmas 2004 to Christmas 2013. So that's what we shall do this week. I'll proceed backwards through time, beginning with last year's Christmas broadcast, then stepping back year by year to 2004. The historic extracts will be prefaced with little pips like this. To avoid confusion between my 2014 voice and my past voices. Brace yourselves then, listeners, to encounter, yes, the ghosts of Radio Derb Christmas Past. In last year's broadcast, I naturally came down with scorn on Barbara Walters' answer when asked on CNN why Barack Obama was having such a struggle meeting the expectations of him when he assumed office. Replied Barbara,
"We thought that he was going to be, I shouldn't say this at Christmas time, but the next Messiah."
I had some fun with that. Notice that we, me and people like me, because, you know, who else matters? We, all right-thinking people. We, the inner party. We, everyone but hillbillies and rednecks. Barbara Walters' we thought that Obama was going to be the next Messiah. What were their evidentiary grounds for thinking this? Obama's lackluster 7 years in the Illinois state legislature? His undistinguished 2 years in the U.S. Senate? I'm not going to count the following 2 years, which he mainly spent running for president. Or was it his gassy, narcissistic, and partly fictional autobiography, really just an extended college application essay? Was it his ineffectual community organizing in Chicago, where he rode from the Tony University neighborhood where he lived to strike poses for an hour or two with church ladies in the ghetto? Was it his editorship of the Harvard Law Review, which left no trace on that periodical? Or was it his short and deeply average career as a lawyer?
"We thought that he was going to be the next Messiah."
Why? Why did you, I mean you plural, yous, you all, why did you think he was going to be the next Messiah? If it wasn't his track record, what was it? I don't think there could be any doubt about the answer. What suggested messiahhood to these gaping, gullible liberals was Obama's wonderful, ineffable, incomparable blackness. Larry Oster was right. To the Barbara Walters of the world, well-behaved blacks are divine. Literally. Our Christmas 2012 broadcast went out on the 22nd, a week after the Sandy Hook shooting, when a lunatic murdered 20 children and 6 adults at an elementary school in Connecticut. I tried to cover all bases on the shooting, Second Amendment issues, treatment of the mentally ill, fatherless kids, and this. And just in case my segment on gun control there left you in any doubt about the connection with liberty, here is the opinion of the Chinese Communist Party, as relayed through their official propaganda network, the so-called Xinhua News Agency. Quote, Obama said of the latest tragedy the country had been through this too many times, and it was time to put aside political differences and take meaningful action to prevent more tragedies like this. Action speaks louder than words. If Obama wants to take practical measures to control guns, he has to make preparation for a protracted war and considerable political cost. End quote. Once again, that was the opinion of the Chinese Communist Party, which not only prohibits its citizens from owning guns, but it prohibits them from owning anything with any security of possession, since the party reserves to itself the right to confiscate property, including land, from anyone at any time. This party, which crushed an unarmed student demonstration with tanks and machine gun fire in 1989, and which 20 years before that plunged China into a decade of disorder, madness and murder, and whose policies 10 years before that caused upwards of 30 million Chinese citizens to starve to death, this party is now shedding crocodile tears, or perhaps dragon tears, at, another quote from Xinhua, the heartbreaking deaths of 20 schoolchildren. The Chinese word for chutzpah, in case you're wondering, is houyan wuchi. Hold on to your guns, citizens. On Christmas 2011, I reported a minor engagement in the War on Christmas. This skirmish took place in the Massachusetts town of Saugus, where the custom has been, the week before Christmas, for one of the town's firefighting vehicles, with Santa aboard, to swing by the town's elementary schools, passing out colouring books to the students. A pretty nice custom, right? Well, the Saugus Superintendent of Schools, name of Langloy, did not think so. He made a phone call to the town fire chief, name of Blanchard. Radio Derb took up the story and then passed an opinion. First thing this last Monday morning, Chief Blanchard got a call from Superintendent Langlois, who, from his picture in the Saugus Advertiser, looks to have the pale, cold blood of Increase Mather and Tribulation Wholesome coursing through his veins. There would be no fire truck riding Santa this year, the superintendent told the chief, because the town authorities should refrain from favouring one religious holiday, that is Christmas, over others, and should more strictly observe separation between church and state. Things were then said and done behind the scenes. We don't know what the things were, but the Advertiser tells us that the super called the chief again around noon, with permission for the Santa tour to go ahead after all. Which was just as well, since 400 colouring books had already been ordered from Bob's discount store in Revere. For a conservative, that's a kind of double-edged story. On the one hand, we have a stone-faced, joyless ideologue depriving little kids of a harmless treat. On the other hand, one of the very oldest and earliest of American traditions, the tradition of, well, stone-faced, joyless ideology, is being kept alive by Superintendent Langlois,
How conservative is that?
My personal opinion is that the good townspeople of Saugus should apply another fine old Massachusetts tradition and strap Superintendent Langlois to a ducking stool.
At Christmas 2010, moved by the idea, a perfectly sound and humane idea in itself, that the Christmas season is a time for reflecting on the lot of those less fortunate than ourselves, I got to thinking about our government welfare programs. That led off into a rant about the fraud, bloat and waste that now seem to be permanent features of the programs SSI, that's Supplemental Security Income, and SSDI, Social Security Disability Insurance. Here was Radio Derb's take on the latter.
Created in 1956, the idea of SSDI was to give income support to people aged 50 to 64 who were disabled and couldn't work. As with SSI, the SSDI program has swollen beyond anything imagined by those who conceived it. The Cato Institute did a report on SSDI, published November 30th this year. As the Cato people point out, there should be much less need for SSDI now than in 1956. Quote, 5 decades of advances in medical treatments and rehabilitative technologies, combined with a secular trend away from physically exertive work, should have reduced the incidence of disabling medical conditions and hence lowered the relative size of the SSDI program. This has not occurred. End quote. It sure hasn't. Payments under SSDI have more than doubled in just the last 15 years, even after you factor in inflation. Welfare programs, once you start them, have a life of their own. There is a whole legal sub-industry dedicated to helping you game these Social Security welfare systems. They even advertise on TV. The whole welfare system is rotten. And it's getting rottener real fast.
In the giving spirit of the Christmas season, I'm going to give Barack Obama and Congress a little bit of credit for getting the federal deficit down. The deficit is what the federal government spends minus what it takes in. The deficit for the last fiscal year, the one that ended September 30th, was a tad less than $500 billion. That's far too much, because the feds spend too much, but it's $200 million less than the previous year, and $900 million less than the number for recession-struck 2009. It never hurts to chide them for their spending extravagance, though, and I did so in the 2009 Christmas broadcast.
See if you can guess who said the following words this week. Quote, in the long run, we can't continue to spend as if deficits don't have consequences, as if waste doesn't matter, as if the hard-earned tax dollars of the American people can be treated like monopoly money. That's what we've seen time and time again. Washington has put off hard choices, spending bill after spending bill, budget after budget. End quote. Okay, who said it? Grover Norquist? National Review? Ron Paul? Nope, that was Barack Obama. Does this guy have a line of patter or what? Did we ever have a president so adept at talking out of both sides of his mouth? Did you ever know a guy so agile at ducking out from the temperance meeting to take a quick swig of Jack Daniels in the men's room? Oh, but the administration is going to stop all this extravagant spending real soon now. It's just for the duration of the present emergency, you see. Far-left radicals like Barack Obama aren't actually keen on big government spend-a-thons. Why on earth would you think that? Our president is a fiscal conservative. And I am Marie of Romania.
At Christmas 2008, I was of course looking forward to the inauguration of President Obama. Although perhaps looking forward doesn't quite catch the spirit of my commentary.
The inauguration of our new president is taking shape. Some mini-controversies have broken out about the arrangements, notably over the choice of Pastor Rick Warren to give the invocation. Pastor Warren would like to conserve the idea of marriage as a privileged contractual union between one man and one woman. As a conservative, I agree with him. So, as a matter of fact, does Barack Obama, who said he was against gay marriage. At least that's what he said when he was trying to get elected. So I don't really see what the fuss is about. With Billy Graham slipping away from us, we need a new guy to preside over the ceremonial deism that is traditional in our public life, and that only the crankiest and most obnoxious kinds of atheists object to. Certainly not me. Pastor Rick is a fine-looking man, who I think will do the job well. Who else are we getting at the inaugural bash? Musical selections from Aretha Franklin, it says here. I guess Pete Seeger wasn't available. And oh no, we're going to get a poem from Elizabeth Alexander, who is to Maya Angelou as Ms. Angelou is to Elizabeth Barrett Browning. As a poetry lover, I'm going to need to know exactly where in the programme this lady shows up, so that I can hit the mute button on my remote. I can tell you what her poem will be like anyway. It won't rhyme or scan or make much sense, and it will contain lots of keening about oppression and injustice, along with some gassy stuff about striving and uplifting, and the soulful wisdom of Apaches and such like. Ms. Alexander is that kind of poet. Anyway, this inauguration will be a huge event. They're expecting 2 to 4 million people. What an extravaganza. I'm trying to imagine what the inauguration of my man, Ron Paul, would have been like. A quick swearing in at a notary's office somewhere, a buffet lunch, and a 300-word address to the nation posted on Ron's Facebook page. That'd be it. And that's how things should be in a commercial republic. As I've already pointed out, though, our days as a commercial republic are far behind us. If living in a commercial republic under limited federal government is what you want, move to Switzerland. This is America, headquarters of a grandiose, bloated, worldwide empire of righteousness. Never mind that the economy's in the tank, the borders undefended, and the whole world hates us. The emperor must have his day of glory.
In 2007, when my son was 12 years old, I noted the need for relentless pressure to get kids doing what they should be doing. Homework, chores, personal hygiene, anything. That was by way of setting up an analogy with our federal legislators.
The United States Congress is kind of like that. The only sure way to get them doing what they ought to be doing is to be tirelessly vigilant and keep the pressure on. Case in point, the border fence. Last year's Secure Fence Act specified, quote, 2 layers of reinforced fencing. It also specified 5 stretches of the border, totaling over 700 miles, where the fence should be built. Well, Congress has just passed a monster spending bill, over $500 billion, containing 9,000 earmarks. And in there, among the countless other clauses of this humongous bill, are a couple that A, remove the requirement for 2 layers of fence, and B, leave the locations of the fence segments to the discretion of border enforcement. The elites in this country are absolutely unshakably determined that illegal immigration shall not be controlled, let alone stopped. It is their top priority, the most important thing in the world to them. The business lobbies, the gated community crowd, the educrats, the mainline churches, the unions, the tort lawyers, the liberal bleeding hearts, they love illegal immigration more than they love their lives. If it's up to them, that fence will never be built. Fortunately, it's not just up to them. As the defeat of this year's amnesty bill proved, we have voices too. The trouble is, we have to keep using them. If we relax for a minute, they slip some atrocity like this through Congress. Keep shouting, keep calling, don't let up.
The Christmas 2006 broadcast also had an item on illegal immigration. In mid-December that year, 6 plants of the meatpacking company Swift & Co. were raided by federal agents. 1,300 illegal immigrants working at the plants were arrested. Said Radio Derb,
"Good. Now, ex-employees of Swift & Co. are suing the firm for conspiring to depress wages by hiring those aliens. Double good. Since we can't get rid of the trial lawyers, let's enlist them in the fight against illegal labour. Meatpacking is not work that Americans won't do. We used to do it at decent wages. These firms hiring in illegals are insulting American citizens and legal residents. I hope Swift & Co. get taken to the cleaners in this civil suit with some hefty punitive damages. And I hope we see more of these lawsuits by people who've lost their jobs to illegals. This is the key to the illegal immigration problem. No jobs, no problem."
Just a follow-up on that. The lawsuit seems to have come to naught, or perhaps was settled out of court. I underestimated the cunning and treachery of the meatpackers, though. Resolutely unwilling to offer wages and working conditions that Americans would accept, but now shy of employing illegals, the meatpackers hooked up with the refugee resettlement industry. They now use refugee workers at the same substandard pay and the same appalling conditions they formerly offered to the illegals. I refer you to the excellent website Refugee Resettlement Watch for the depressing details. You might grumble that commentary in support of the death penalty isn't really very Christmassy. But the subject was in my mind at Christmas 2005, owing to the execution of Tookie Williams at San Quentin Prison on the 13th of the month. Williams was a savage and heartless murderer, a cold psychopath who staged redemption in prison and became the darling of various community activist and bleeding heart liberal groups. They could have executed him on Christmas Day, wearing a Santa hat and holding a plum pudding and a glass of eggnog, for all I could have cared. In my Christmas broadcast, I mainly took issue with the method of execution. Thus.
After 24 years on death row, Tookie Williams, founder of the Crips street gang and convicted multiple murderer, finally got his ticket punched in San Quentin prison. Personally, I have no problem with capital punishment, and I'm glad Williams got his just deserts at last. I do, however, deplore the spreading use of lethal injection as a means of dispatch. I don't see why we should hide from ourselves the fact that we are doing an act of violence to one of society's enemies. It has always seemed to me that the firing squad is an ideal way to kill these people. It gets ordinary citizens involved, and it has a Second Amendment cachet that should appeal to all conservatives. Lethal injection is just an insult to the medical profession. I think it was George Carlin who wondered aloud whether they swab the injection site with antiseptic before inserting the needle. And Tookie, according to news reports, actually had to help them find a vein. This lethal injection business is just prettying up something that not only can't be made pretty, but shouldn't be.
The Christmas 2004 broadcast was unusual in that I sang most of it. I don't think I ever repeated the experiment, and you'd better hope I didn't. The songs I sang were topical spoofs on Christmas songs. Here, for example, is one on the Democratic candidate in that year's presidential election. He lost, but hold back those tears. He later got a gig as Secretary of State in the Obama administration. Eh, they just won't lie down.
Frosty the candidate was a chilly kind of soul, with his lantern jaw and his pompadour and his icy self-control. Frosty the candidate was a decorated vet, with a Senate seat where he couldn't be beat, he just looked like a safe bet. There must have been some magic in the way that he campaigned, for when it came convention time, nomination he'd attained. Oh, Frosty the candidate came on strong in the debates, and out on the trail seemed he couldn't fail to swing some crucial states. But then his wartime comrades, feeling cheated and betrayed, showed us how he'd lied, slandered men who died in that long-ago decade. Oh, Frosty the candidate started slipping in the polls. By election night he'd slipped out of sight with his story full of holes. Thumpety thump thump, thumpety thump thump, look at Frosty go. Thumpety thump thump, thumpety thump thump, goodbye gigolo.
That's it, folks. I hope you enjoyed that little visit from the ghost of Christmas past. It only remains to thank you for listening to and supporting Radio Derb, and to wish you everything you hope for in the coming year. Merry Christmas, everybody.